Bright Minds, the podcast from the John Adams Institute, is brought to you by the members of the John Adams. Why not become a member yourself, or even better, a patron, and enjoy all the extras and benefits? Find out more at john-adams.nl, john-adams.nl, and click on Become a Member. From Amsterdam, this is Bright Minds, the podcast from the John Adams Institute, a treasure trove of the best and the brightest of American thinking. And this is Pulitzer-winning New York Times investigative reporter Andrea Elliott dispelling myths about what it's like to be poor in America.
Always working. It just doesn't look like work in terms of the formal labor market. It's just, it's not a 9-to-5 job, but man, you can't survive if you're not hustling, if you're not figuring out where the next meal is coming or how to get a loan from this. The wheels of your mind of survival are always turning. The idea that the poor don't work is just wrong. They must work.
Andrea Elliott's 2022 Pulitzer-winning book, Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival, and Hope in an American City, follows 8 dramatic years in the life of a young woman named Dasani Coates. She was just 11 when they met. Dasani's family have become emblematic of one of America's most wicked problems, homelessness. And this book is a powerful expose on just how the disparity between those with wealth and power and those without is rapidly growing. Ms. Elliott was interviewed in Amsterdam's Vondelkerk in October of 2022 by the John Adams director, Tracy Metz. But first, Andrea Elliott entered storytelling mode and started by reading a passage from her book, a passage that she says really encapsulates just why this book matters and, more than anything, just why Dasani's life is as important a life as anyone else's.
To know Dasani Joni LaShawn Coates, to follow this child's life from her first breaths in a Brooklyn hospital to the bloom of adulthood, is to reckon with the story of New York City and beyond its borders with America itself. Sound familiar? All writing is derivative, I will say that. It is a story that begins at the dawn of the 21st century, in a global financial capital riven by inequality. It is also a story that reaches back in time to one black family making its way through history. From slavery to the Jim Crow South, and then the Great Migration's passage north. There is no separating Dasani's childhood from that of her matriarchs, her grandmother Joni and her mother Chanel. Their fleeting triumphs and deepest sorrows are, in Dasani's words, my heart. The ground beneath her feet once belonged to them. Her city is paved over theirs. It was in Brooklyn that Chanel was also named for a fancy-sounding bottle spotted in a magazine in 1978. Back then, from the ghetto's isolated corners, a perfume ad was the portal to a better place. Today, Dasani lives surrounded by wealth. Whether she's peering into the boho chic shops near her shelter or surfing the internet on Auburn's shared computer, she sees out to a world that rarely sees her. To see Dasani is to see all the places of her life, from the corridors of school to the emergency rooms of hospitals to the crowded vestibules of family court and welfare. Some places are more felt than seen. The place of homelessness, of sisterhood, of a mother-child bond that nothing can break. They dwell within Dasani wherever she goes. To follow Dasani as she comes of age is to follow her 7 siblings. Whether they are riding the bus, switching trains, climbing steps, or jumping puddles, they always move as one. Only together have they learned to navigate poverty's systems, ones with names suggesting help, child protection, public assistance, criminal justice, homeless services. To watch these systems play out in Dasani's life is to glimpse their power their flaws, and the threat they pose to Dasani's own system of survival. Her siblings are her greatest solace, their separation her greatest fear. This is freighted by other forces beyond her control: hunger, violence, racism, homelessness, parental drug addiction, pollution, segregated schools. Any one of these afflictions could derail a promising child. As Dasani grows up, she must contend with them all. I could only write that because I had watched her grow up by then. At the very, very beginning of this process, in 2012, it was a fall day, sunny, October in 2012, when I was standing outside her homeless shelter looking for a way into this story. And that is when I met her standing outside. Never did I imagine in that moment that I would follow this family for what became nearly a decade. She was 11 years old, and she was living in this homeless shelter in Brooklyn with her parents, Chanel and Supreme, and her seven siblings. And in the years that came, how do I even summarize this? Because I'm looking at the time. I would witness the most outrageous forms of systemic oppression and the most remarkable and even heroic acts of courage, resilience, and love. And I would come to question every assumption that people have about the poor. This was a true education. This all began with a statistic. I was sitting at my computer and I saw the statistic that 1 in 5 children in America are growing up poor. And I couldn't believe it. I said, that can't be right. In raw numbers, today in America, we're talking about a population of about 13 million children. At that time, it was 16 million. Growing up poor in the world's richest superpower, which it turns out is also the country with the highest child poverty rate of any developed nation. This is all the more striking when you consider the research. And in those early days, when I was just thinking about child poverty as the subject and where to go with that, I did what journalists do, which was to call experts and delve into the research in the very beginning. And it was scary, because what you see when you look at the research is that poor kids are twice as likely to be incarcerated, to have children as single parents, to suffer from costly health ailments like diabetes, like asthma. They are less likely to participate in the labor market because many drop out of high school. They never complete their education. The future of these children is not only tragic, it's expensive. Child poverty is a really costly problem. And yet, the public discourse on the poor is so rarely about the children. It's usually about the adults. It's a common belief that the poor are to blame for their condition, that they have made poor choices, that they lack personal responsibility, that they lack self-reliance. And as I continue to read about poverty, what I saw was that it's understandable that that's the rhetoric, because it's easier to take that position than to truly reckon with the structural issues facing poor communities, things like segregated schools, polluted air, inadequate education, food insecurity, barriers to employment, exposure to violence that can lead to trauma, that can lead to drug addiction as a form of self-soothing. These are really complicated problems, issues. I hate that word, by the way. What does it even mean, issues, right? We don't see issues. What we see are the people that issues represent. And the people we tend to see are the adults, not the children. And so when I set out to write about poverty, I decided to focus only on the children. And those of you who are familiar with Charlie Brown, the Americans in the audience, will know what I mean when I say the adults, in my view of my story that I was going to tell, would just go wah, 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 like you can't even hear them. It's just the kids. Just the kids. This was how I planned to unburden the story of the politics of self-reliance and the politics of personal responsibility, the politics of blame, let's call it that. All of the noise around whose fault it is. Because number one, I like my writing to reach as broad an audience as possible. I don't care what your politics are. I don't half the time even know what my own politics are. I tend to stay away from that as a writer. I go deep into human stories to try to get at something that will show me a truth I didn't know before. And that's what I want readers to do as well. And wherever you sit on the political spectrum, you cannot deny that, or even argue, right, that 13 million American children are responsible for their own lot, for their own well-being, or that their poverty is a result of their own poor choices. You can't even argue that, right? They exist. You can't argue with that either. And the stakes are huge. The stakes are huge. We're talking about, in the worst moments of recent history, 1/5 of our future workforce growing up in adversity. That alone makes this a hugely important problem. And so, okay, I need to tell this story through the lens of a child. I need to get inside the world of a child. And that's what led me to Dasani. And on that fall day, standing outside, and, you know, I'd interviewed dozens of kids all around the country at this point. And I knew by now that what mattered more than any particular demographic profile or story was finding a child who wanted to narrate her own experience, who was loquacious, who actually liked to talk. And by the way, who was funny, that didn't hurt because I like to laugh. And Dasani was really funny from the moment I met her. She had me in stitches. She just had this like spark about her. I mean, you meet her and you know things are going to happen for this kid one way or another. And she was the strongest girl at the park doing her pull-ups. She was the fastest sprinter on the block. She was on the honor roll at school. So you meet a kid like that standing on the street and you think, oh my God, it's going to be fun to follow her life because her life is only an upward trajectory. What could possibly stand in her way? What I didn't see in that first conversation, because I wasn't allowed to see it, because it was off limits to the public, was the reality of her home life inside that shelter, which was run by a city with a nearly, the shelter itself was millions of dollars, and then the budget of the city was over almost $1 billion every year to run the shelter system. And here in this city-run shelter, her family of 10 people were crammed in one room, right? One room overrun by mice, roaches, mold. They were relieving themselves in a mop bucket at night because they were too afraid to use the communal bathroom, with good reason. They were heating the crib. I was having a conversation today with Jana about this, with a hairdryer, because the heat would turn off and the baby would get cold. Incredible acts of innovation, by the way. As an outsider, first looking in, which happens at the beginning of the book, it's shocking. These are horrible, squalid, awful, Dickensian conditions in the world's richest city, one of the world's richest cities, New York City. How is this possible? I wasn't going to be able to see that myself until I snuck in 8 months later. At that time, I relied on the family to take video and to report, and I did a bunch of investigative stuff, and I was undercover because I didn't want the city to blow up the story. But one thing that I didn't see at first that I've come to see now is that from Dasani's perspective, you cannot reduce her life to the horror that it represents to most people. It's not just horrible. She sees the horror, but she, being a kid, found ways to see past the horror that she was, because children are innovative. They innovate. They find beauty where we don't. She literally found it in the fluorescent lights that would make the rooms look so dull. She and her siblings climbed up on a dresser, removed the lamp, colored it in the shades of a rainbow, put it back up, and suddenly they had a rainbow. She literally found it on her window, and she'd go to her window every morning, waking up before she helped the kids get to school, and look out at the Empire State Building, because, as she put it in her words, it makes me feel like there's something going on out there. And that's what moved me more than anything, was the tension between what could be her life and what was her life. What could be her life, by the way, wasn't some imaginary distant planet, because this is gentrified Brooklyn. This is a Brooklyn like parts of Amsterdam, like parts of all over cities all over the world. We've seen this happen. A return to the city, revitalization, you can call it by different names, but often what it means is that people who cannot afford to stay there get run out, and the most deeply poor set who have subsidized housing that can't be undone remain. And they are in closer proximity to wealth than prior generations. This is a radically different way of growing up poor than anyone in Dasani's family had ever experienced. Her mother had grown up in the 80s in Brooklyn, getting her name Chanel from a magazine, right? Because her mother was pregnant and the magazine ad was the closest way to get into that other world. Aspiration, Chanel, that's what I want for my daughter. By the time Chanel was pregnant with Dasani, the bottled water had just come out and it was right there in the bodega. It was on the shelf. Who would pay for water? So Chanel wanted to know. This is like, as a good New Yorker, no New Yorker likes to diss, you know, the tap water. It's a, like, very high quality tap water, but even still, you know, to pay for water, what a sign of luxury. And she loved the sound of it, Dasani. But hey, it was also right there. It wasn't a magazine ad. It was right in front of her. And that's because the wealth had come. The people who could afford to pay for the water were now living in her part of Brooklyn. And so Dasani could see all of this. And so here's a passage I will read that I've never read before to an audience. And it is one of my favorite moments of reporting, of many favorite moments. I will stop there. On the Brooklyn block that is Dasani's dominion, shoppers can buy a $3 malt liquor in an airless deli where food stamps are traded for cigarettes. Or they can cross the street for a $740 mega bottle of Chardonnay at an industrial chic wine shop decorated with modern art. A sign outside that locale, Gnarly Vines, catches Dasani's notice one April afternoon. Wine tasting tonight, 5 to 8 p.m. Dasani is hardly conversant in the subject of libations, but this much she knows. A little drink will soften her mother's edge. Dasani points out the sign, and without further ado, Chanel heads into the wine shop on Myrtle Avenue, trailed by four of her children. They are lugging two greasy boxes of pizza and a jumbo pack of diapers from Target. The cashier pauses. The sommelier smiles. "Want to try a little rosé?" she asks brightly, pouring from a 2012 bottle of Mas de Gourgogne. I'm sure I mispronounced that, whatever that's called. "I would describe it as definitely fruit-forward at the beginning." Chanel polishes it off. "But really crisp. Dry, refreshing, not refreshing," Chanel says. "I think just dry." "No, it's very dry," says the sommelier, a peppy blonde in wire-rimmed glasses. "It's high acid, a little citrusy." Chanel sticks out her tongue. She finds the woman's choice of words unappetizing. As if sensing the distance, the lady sweetens her tone. "You can try anything she wants," she says. "I'm just letting you know." "I'm a try 'em all," Chanel replies. "This is a Greek white," says the sommelier. To the side of the wine display is a large silver vase, which looks strikingly similar to the children's grandmother's urn. Kalik, Dasani's brother, stares at the vase. "This is for putting people in, right?" he asks the sommelier. Chanel rolls her eyes. "That is not an urn," she scoffs. "Oh my gosh, for cremation?" the sommelier asks, shaking her head. "We just use it for spinning in." "For spinning?" Chanel says with horror. "Yeah, it's got rejected wine in it," the sommelier says. Chanel sniffs. She might not like the wine, but she sees no reason to reject it. She moves on to a Tuscan Sangiovese. Ignoring the spectacle, Dasani scans the room. She frowns at a sign on the wall for liqueur. "They got liquor spelled wrong," Dasani yelps triumphantly. "Actually," the sommelier interjects, "that is a French word for the delicate liquid spirits derived from fruits such as pomegranates and raspberries." "But you're very right," she offers. "That is not how you spelled liquor." "Not the hood liquor," Chanel says. This is their world, right? Looking at time here. Okay, we've got some time. So I've spent, years I actually like to describe, I love that you talked about Gerard describing our work as everyday journalism. I like to talk about what I do as walking with. It's walking with or standing with the people. It's so much of it is just being with them. If you're lucky enough to work for a place that affords you that amount of time, or you can find enough grants or fellowships to support that work. My goal as a journalist is, I often tell people, to understand. I'm here because I want to understand. I don't, you know, I've written about a lot of things that are hard to understand over many years, including militant jihad, and you know, I'm rarely an insider in the worlds that I report on. But I kind of got tired of hearing myself say that, like, I'm here, I want to understand. So I finally looked up the etymology of the word, and it comes from Old English, and literally, what does understand mean? It means to stand in the midst of. It doesn't mean you've arrived at some kind of ultimate truth, because no such thing really can happen. It just means, to my mind, that I have, and I've written about this, you know, I've experienced enough of something new to be humbled by it, to be provoked by it, to even possibly be changed by it. And I think if I did anything in all these years with Dasani, it was to stand in the midst of her life, whether it was in this wine shop or it was at the welfare center where we stood in line for hours on end, or it was on the train, or it was, you know, at all hours, I slept on their floor in Staten Island. I felt that that was the kind of immersion that their story required. And what I found over the years that I reported this book was that for each layer that I pulled back, I would find a new layer, a new thing that I had to understand. and not from a reporter perspective, but really in terms of research and history and policy, I was constantly scrambling to figure it all out. And how do I summarize this? I guess what I would say is, what does it mean to be poor? What is poverty? I hate labels, and because they're misleading. They kind of give us, they're lazy is what they are. Labels are a way to sort of say, I've given enough attention to this issue with this label, and I can now turn to something else. Poverty is not the presence of something, it's the lack of something. It's the material reality of Dasani's life. It's her lack of money. Right? That's what poverty is. But that's merely the point of departure for understanding her human condition. I see these labels as signposts. They're guiding you somewhere. It's the air she breathes. It informs all parts of her family life, housing, education, health, employment, parenting. And for this family, there was no separating poverty from race, from the daily assault of systemic and societal racism in America. And so the story of racial segregation in Brooklyn was pivotal to what happened to Dasani's family. And I can't look at that without also looking at the history of the family coming from the Jim Crow South during the Great Migration, and then going back further in history to the slavery that came before it. All of these pieces were interconnected. And, you know, over the years of researching the book, I examined more than 14,000 records. And every once in a while, a small miracle would happen in this search, in this exhaustive and endless search for how to tell this story in the most rigorous way possible, so that you couldn't just stop with Dasani as a quote-unquote poor kid, but you start with Dasani as a poor kid. What is her poverty telling us about history in America, about her family in particular? Why is she poor? Where did that start? Why did it persist? So she had a great-grandfather named June Sykes, and all I knew about him was that he mopped floors on the night shift, that he liked to drink, and that he told lots of scary stories about some distant war. That's what people said. No one believed him, none of his kids. One of his daughters, Linda, she said, "What they say, a drunk person always speaks a sober mind." He was speaking a sober mind. I just didn't want to hear him. I couldn't hear him either because he had died in 1987. So the only way I could find out anything was to see, well, maybe he did serve. I reached out to the National Archives. In comes this file. This is one of the small miracles from the National Archives. Hundreds of records. He had enlisted in the Army at the height of World War II when the military was still segregated. And then he had joined the 92nd Infantry, which was the only black division to fight in Europe during World War II. He survived three major battles in Italy, and he returned home with three Bronze Service Stars and two medals. And then I continued to look for wage records and piece together his story and learned how, after fighting the Nazis and fascists in Europe, he returned to an America where black people still could not vote, could not get loans to go to college, could not buy homes because their neighborhoods had been redlined and the suburbs prevented them from moving in. And that even as a decorated war veteran, qualified to receive all of those things I just mentioned under the GI Bill, that June Sykes was essentially denied his rightful place in America. Things he should have gotten just for being human, but also the fact that he had just fought for his country and still was denied. He wound up working as a janitor, even though he was trained as a mechanic. He cobbled together more than 30 jobs. The guy worked, at one point, he's working five jobs when Joni, Tassani's grandmother, was born. And, I mean, just to give you an idea, so janitors earned 41% less than mechanics. You look at the gap between those two incomes, because let's be really clear about what we're talking about. It's not just an idea like this guy in history and race. No, let's give it a number. He lost nearly $200,000 in income because of where he was forced to work and how. And that's the safety net right there. I think that that's what laid the foundations of this lasting poverty that Tassani would inherit. Okay, looking at time, 5 minutes left. Let's see. I'm going to speed ahead. And I mentioned in the beginning, I'm going to read one more passage in our remaining minutes before we begin our conversation. We're doing pretty well, right? Trying to adhere to the rules here. By the way, I love rules, and it's the only way that I could deliver on this book was to be very organized myself. So I bow down. I respect these rules. And plus, I could talk forever, so you need to actually give me some limits. So poverty, another thing about it, you know, when you talk about these labels, I think I'm actually realizing this as I say it, I'm kind of thinking out loud here, but if I did anything here with this book, it was to make things as visceral as possible, right? So it's not just the idea that there are all these systems out there and these systems govern Tassani's life, but there's actually like a physical geography to poverty. It is something that is lived, that is felt, that is sensed, that is seen by a child as a map. This is the map at the beginning of my book. You know how I got this map? I said to Tassani, I was very frustrated trying to write this section about welfare history and policy. And she could tell. She said, Drea, what's wrong? I said, it's much more fun to be on the street with you. I don't want to be sitting here going through all these academic studies. I'm trying to make visible for people all these systems because I want to write about this in a way that keeps them on the page. Writing about systems with acronyms, it's like an exit ramp for readers. And I want to make this visual, almost like a map. And I was calling up experts. Can somebody give me a map of all these systems and how they overlap? And one person said to me, who'd been working for decades in these systems in New York, like, no, but if you find one, will you send it to me? So I said to Tassani, you give me the map. Systems, the map. Where are they? Oh, that's easy. The Bronx is DHS, Department of Homeless Services. That's where we always go when we get locked out of the system. Queens is HRA, which is the welfare office. Brooklyn is ACS, the Administration for Children's Services, Child Protection. Every single part of New York existed in her imagination, not even in her imagination, in her reality, as a map that is unseen by other people, but that is like lived by thousands of kids every day. That each place has an acronym. I was stunned. And you'll see it if you look at this. It's something that really, really got inside of me. And of all of those acronyms, none had the power that ACS had, because ACS had the power to dismantle Tassani's own system of survival, which was her and her siblings, their ability to stay together. And it did happen. It happened in front of me. I was there that day. October 6th, actually, so last week of 2015. The children were taken in front of me and removed from the home. The parents were charged with neglect, not abuse. Very important distinction we could talk about later. And their lives changed forever after that moment. I'm going to close with a passage that came 3 years later. The kids had all been in the foster care system. No one was closer than Dasani and Aviana. Aviana was named after the pricier brand of Evian bottled water. She's 11 months younger Irish twins. They were so close. They shared the same pillow, the same drawer. They had secret handshakes. I said, I don't care how messed up the foster care system is, nothing is getting in between these two. And it got so bad that they hadn't spoken in a year. Forever family, writes Dasani on December 3rd, 2017, above a photograph on Facebook showing three new friends. They are throwing gang signs. Dasani, now 16, knows that her estranged sister, Aviana, will be rankled by this. To write forever family is Dasani's way of saying the opposite, that nothing is forever, not even family, that one's sister can be replaced as easily as one's own blood, which is not thicker than water, as their mother used to say. In the photograph, Dasani wears a red bandana in allegiance to the Bloods, the gang, the Bloods. One family is poised to take another, to take the place of another. Dasani has not seen Aviana in over a year. They last exchanged texts 5 months ago, but Dasani knows how to break her sister's silence. Precisely 2 hours and 35 minutes after Dasani posts the Forever Family photo, Aviana appears on Facebook, clicking a digital hand. The hand waves at her sister. Dasani waves back. "Hey, sis," writes 15-year-old Aviana. A feverish correspondence follows. They agree to meet the following weekend at a subway station in Queens. They are both nervous, so Aviana sends detailed instructions. Dasani must take the A train to Broadway Junction, then the J train to Queens, to the last stop, get off, go upstairs, and then meet me at the turnstile. Queens is not Dasani's turf. She asks for the name of the station, which worries Aviana. Nothing can be left to chance. Instead, they settle on Broadway Junction, which is impossible to miss. "Got you, sis," Aviana writes. On the afternoon of December 10th, Aviana leaves her foster home in Queens, and Dasani leaves her foster home in Staten Island. They check their phones. "I'm on the train," writes Aviana. "Me too," writes Dasani. By 1:28 p.m., they are minutes apart. Both trains arrive, and the sisters dismount. They cannot find each other. Aviana writes that she is here. Dasani writes that she is coming upstairs. Aviana writes that she is coming down. "No," Dasani writes, "she's coming up." "Where are you at?" Dasani asks. "Aviana is at the turnstile." "Come to the escalators," writes Dasani. The thread stops. The station stops. Two sisters are crashing into each other. They have no words. They hold each other like refugees who have crossed an unseen border. Everyone is watching. "Mind your own damn business," Dasani manages to shout from her sister's impossible clutch. "She cannot breathe like this. No one hugs like this. You're holding me too tight. Let me go. Let me go." No one lets go. They stand like this for minutes. They already know their next move. The A train will come, taking them to downtown Brooklyn, where their mother is waiting. The train is coming, the very train that their grandmother used to clean. It pulls into the station. The doors open. I think we should stop there.
And this is where Adams Institute director Tracy Metz joined Andrea Elliott for a conversation about why she wanted to tell this real-life story and the power of and the difficulties of this kind of immersion journalism.
Andrea, I'm so glad that you read one of the passages that I myself love so much, because it was one of the passages that really made me laugh out loud. And when I started on this book, I could never have thought that there would be a passage that would make me laugh out loud. So I was grateful to you for that.
I hope you mean the second passage. Otherwise, I would begin to worry. Not my intention to make you laugh. No, the wine was unbelievable. It's one of those things that happened.
Were you there?
Yes.
You must have been.
Oh, yes. I mean, I
never rely on my own memory, you know, so I use a lot of, I have video and audio, and I interviewed everyone multiple times. I went back and talked to the poor sommelier. It was just one of those moments where I was like, I can't believe this is happening. And then when Dasani's like, they got liquor spelled wrong, I was just like, no, this is, it's just like, it was like, I couldn't have asked for a kind of a more sort of potent kind of crystallizing moment of these two worlds coming together, colliding, really, right? And everyone trying to be their best, you know, even though it was really awkward. Yeah.
And the sommelier still trying to be polite and thinking, oh, where is this going? And I was also struck by the fact that Dasani knew that liqueur is not the right spelling for liquor.
Oh, yeah, this is a family that loves words. But it was also like, it got me thinking, like, you know, we don't, those who are lucky enough to grow up around wine culture, I mean, you don't, do you really think about the fact that you're rejecting the wine, you're spitting it out? To see it from Chanel's perspective, like, that's outrageous. How could you do that? And then...
What a waste.
And then, right.
And I had never heard the term rejected wine before. I thought, oh, yeah. Highfalutin. I really enjoyed it. And there was such an unexpected moment of hilarity in this book, which, well, not everything is to be laughed about in this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
First you saw Chanel on the street, her mom, and then you saw Dasani. And I wondered, was it a kind of journalistic love at first sight that you saw this bright, lively girl living in the most difficult of circumstances, and that you knew, this is my story?
You know, I love that frame because what is, you know, as journalists, we are trained to be afraid of our own emotions. And so you think about even words like love, most journalists, and I belong to this camp for a long time, are almost allergic to that, like love, you know. Feelings, emotions, they get in the way of our pursuit of the truth and balance and rigor. That's, I think, how I used to see it. And I've landed in a very different place after all of these years, which is to see the role of emotions, not just to not see it as an impediment, but almost to see it as essential. To see, like, if I'm feeling something strong, I've got to listen to that. And if I'm responding with interest and attentiveness to someone, the reader will do the same. And the opposite is true. If somebody's not really grabbing me, how am I ever going to make this come alive? So, you know, you are the portal in a way. And to delve in for months or even years with one family, with one subject, with one person, requires just tremendous devotion. And so I like that you mentioned love, because I've come to also see that as, you know, it's a little bit like I'd been looking for a book before that and nothing ever felt right. This wasn't even a decision. This book came and...
It happened to you.
It just took possession of me completely. I didn't have a choice. I knew I had to do this.
And so, that does sound like love at first sight.
I think so. Yeah, no, I think that's right. For sure, because it was bigger than me in a way. I just didn't have a choice. I knew it. I was mesmerized. Mm-hmm. I felt truly, you know, you said you laughed during that one scene and you didn't expect to. I don't think of this as a catalog of sorrows, even though there's a lot of hard stuff in this book. I see the emotional through line of the book as one of joy, because most of the time that's what I felt in their presence. I felt electrified. I felt joyful. I laughed harder than I've ever laughed in my life when I was with them. There was just the hope. People ask me about the hope in the title. That's where it comes from. It's just their very existence is such a powerful, like, act of humanity. It's, to be around them, it makes you want to believe in the best parts of humanity.
Yeah. Although our image of poverty is so much the downtrodden, this seems to really contradict a lot of the stereotypes that I discovered by reading this book that I had, that I'd never really thought about before.
Yeah, I that same thing happened to me. Stereotypes like poor people don't want to work, for example, which is a very common belief. And I think I probably shared it on some level. I probably thought, you know, a lot of poor folks, this comes from, it's not just poor people, it may be people who are struggling with addiction. It comes from my own personal experience of my older brother who passed away, but before he died, you know, who'd struggled very much with alcoholism for decades. So I understood that, you know, things can become bigger than you, and that you can get overwhelmed by circumstance, and it's not really your fault, but if you only did things differently, it could, you know, I brought in that frame. I wondered about their addiction, the parents, and did it get in the way of leading a much more fulfilling or productive life? And I think that's just a very privileged kind of lens, because what you see when you're with which is not my brother. My brother had my family and a lot of protections and resources that they didn't have. When you're with people who are truly downtrodden, and I don't quarrel with that word because they are trodden upon, I do think of it as larger than these people. What you see is that they're always working. It just doesn't look like work in terms of the formal labor market. It's just, it's not a 9-to-5 job, but man, you can't survive if you're not hustling, if you're not figuring out where the next meal is coming or how to get a loan from this. The wheels of your mind of survival are always turning. This is the idea that the poor don't work is just wrong. They must work. It's just not, it's a different kind of work.
You said at one point
underground economy, bartering sometimes. It's this whole network of kin.
Hustling.
Yeah. And it's, that's just one of many examples of things. I mean, another is that, you know, a family like this wants to live off the government, for example. Well, let me just start with the fact that, you know, Brooklyn is filled with people who live off of trust funds. Okay. I mean, Chanel and I would talk about that. We would walk around, she'd see like all these 20 somethings and they're just sitting around all day on, you know, like sipping.
Drinking latte.
Yes. How is that? Anyway, that's the private safety net. We don't talk about that.
Have you ever heard of a trust fund?
No, I'm thinking we listened to Hamilton. I'm a trust fund baby. You can trust me. We did listen to that, and I talked about that line in Hamilton with her. That just came back. No, I don't think she had. But we talked about it. That's something that I introduced her. You know, this was a relationship that, you know, was, I think, mutually. I don't even know how to talk about it. Like it changed us both. You know, we were constantly showing other things that were new to the other person. And, but I don't know. We've gone off the path. I can't remember what we were talking about before the trust fund thing came up, but it was something to do
working.
With, yeah.
Always working.
A family like this wanted to depend on the government. Okay. This is a family that had two children at the very minimum who qualified for disability, which would have brought in another $1,000 a month, most likely. Chanel and Supreme refused to take that benefit because they didn't want their children to carry that label. You know, and so, and this is much more common than you would think. This, it's not, I think that they really caused me to rethink so many assumptions and see things in a new way.
As you read the book, you come to realize how close you became to them and how much they trusted you. But in the beginning, they didn't know you. They didn't, you know, you were the kind of person who usually came to them in the form of a police agent. Yep. Or someone from the ambulance or someone from the child services. Your kind of person was usually the one to be distrusted. How did you win their trust?
I don't see trust as something that is won so much as something that is potentially won, but that is hard fought all along. So it's a work in progress. It's not a destination. It's not something you arrive at and then you're there and you got it and you're done. I think in the healthiest reporter source relationships, it should always be considered a gift and something that could easily be withdrawn, because they had no reason to trust me. And I don't even, you know, people ask me a lot about trust. I don't know what trust, full trust, would even look like. It would make me nervous for them. I think they had to know they had to remember always that a reporter was in the room. And so maybe a little bit of distrust is a healthy thing. But how
did you feel through all these years that you were always on thin ice with them?
That's a really good question. I mean, no, most of the time I was not, but there were times when I was. What I would say is that it's not that I won their trust. It's that I won their belief in the value of this shared project, that they were living their lives and I was witnessing their lives being lived by them. And those two things together was going to lead to this story being told. That's what they trusted. I think that's what they believed in. And they saw that all along as something that was important, but it got tested in really powerful and difficult ways. The biggest test of my relationship with Tasani's mother came after the children were taken and she lost the legal right to see them, but I did not because I was not their parent. So I could continue to see her kids when she could not. She had to see them only under supervision, and it understandably drove a wedge between us and created a real crisis. Actually, that was the closest we came to, I thought Chanel was going to pull the plug, basically. But Dasani...
But it wasn't because she distrusted you.
She was angry at me, understandably angry, because I'll just put it this way, because to protect Chanel, I will just say that if she were to think that I might bring her along in one of my visits to Dasani, she was well in her right to expect that, right? Morally, because I knew that she would pose no threat to Dasani. I could have easily made that visit happen. But if I had done that, I would have been violating a court order. So... that is where the rubber met the road. And I had to say, I'm sorry, but I can't do this. I cannot break the rules were never broken. Let me just put it that way. But she had every right to expect that they might be. And
to hope that they would be.
And I think another reporter might have done that, actually. And I wouldn't have faulted that person. I just felt that I couldn't. And it was really complicated. It resolved. She wound up seeing Dasani on her own with a social worker present. And it actually was, I think, a healthy exercise at the end of the day because she did need to see that there was a limit. But, you know, these are the things that happen. And I also don't think Dasani would have pulled out. I think it would have just been her mother at that point because Dasani, of course, wanted me to continue to be. She had lost so much at that point. And so she was like, you can't disappear as well. But, yeah, there's so much to say about that.
Yeah. Yeah. What's next?
Oh, well, I don't have a good answer for what's next.
You're still recovering.
I am working on a piece. All I will say about it is that it is about the impact of gun violence on one child's life. I'm at the New York Times, going back to the New York Times after a very long book leave. And I'm waiting for my next book to come, you know,
like an epiphany.
Co-opt my entire life. Exactly. Grab hold of me and take over. Yeah.
I'm really glad to hear you say that because I've done nothing on the epic scale of this book, but I have written several books. And I just know it's like the proverbial light that went on above my head.
Yeah.
This is it.
This is it.
You just
exactly.
know.
You know.
And then it takes over.
And that's
so now you know what's right? waiting
it's
for you the next round.
Thank and then you I'll so come back and talk Andrea. About it.
Yes.
I hope. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Adams Institute Director Tracy Metz there in conversation with Andrea Elliott, the author of Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival, and Hope in an American City. They spoke at the Fondelkerk in October of 2022. And a portion of the proceeds of Invisible Child go to helping Dasani's family and others like them. There's a donation link in the show notes. And one final update. Dasani was the first child in her family to graduate from high school, and she's now working part-time and studying business at a community college. She says she feels successful. Did you know that you can go to our website, john-adams.nl/videos, where there is a link to this extraordinary event? And we also have a newsletter you can sign up for and a treasure trove of American thinkers and speakers at john-adams.nl. And while you're there, become a member of the John Adams. Not only do you support the podcast, you support what we do, you also get a discount to future live events. In the meantime, go to wherever you get your podcasts and leave a review of this show. This will help get the word out, and we can keep on sharing the very best of American thinkers with you, free of charge. That's it for this week's show. Our theme song is called La Prensa by the Parlandos. Our editor is Tracy Metz from Amsterdam. This was Bright Minds, the podcast from the John Adams Institute. I'm Jonathan Gruber. Thank you for listening.